Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Laura Storm, an experienced thought leader and international keynote speaker. Laura is a young global leader at the World Economic Forum, where she supports their work as an expert in sustainable development and climate change. Under Laura's leadership, Sustainia became a global megabrand within sustainability, with an outreach to more than 170 million people and the world's largest database of 4,000 proven sustainable solutions. I spoke to Laura online from her home in Copenhagen. So Laura, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited about being part of this.
Oh, me too. You're a busy lady.
I'm trying not to be. I'm trying to kind of have fun with the flow.
So I'm just really excited about you joining us. There's lots to talk about, but maybe we just start out by, I'm just curious as to what drives you.
What has always kind of driven me is a very deep craving for changing the model we have based our society on. And I actually remember having that urge already as a very young kid, that kind of looking, in a way, feeling like the odd one out, looking at the society that I was living in and be like, is this it? Why are grown-ups so busy? Why are adults destroying the rainforest? These kind of questions that started out of curiosity and grew into a bit of anger, and partly having a desire to quickly be a grown-up so I could start changing things, but also having slight anxiety attacks about becoming a grown-up because I did not want to be part of that community. And I actually, when I was around 8 or 9 years old, I remember seeing a documentary about how oil companies were destroying the Amazon rainforest. And that kind of anger and determination that I had to do something about that, I remember so vividly. And I started a little campaign with friends about collecting money to actually buy pieces of the rainforest and promised myself to go there as soon as I was old enough. Which I did. So I've always had this drive to kind of change things and protect nature, basically.
Where do you think that comes from? I mean, were there people in your life who were role modeling that kind of engaged citizen, around you at the time?
Definitely my parents, who when they were young, they were quite politically active. And both within environmentalism, but also kind of social issues, and were involved in a lot of things in the 80s. Primarily, though, before I was born, I think kind of work life took over a bit for them when they had me and my brother. But they were always very kind of active, and especially around environmental issues, and were very, in the 80s, buying organic produce, for example, was not really a thing, but they were very dedicated to do that. And I remember my dad taking the bicycle. We lived in a city of Copenhagen when I was a kid. And I remember he took his bicycle and came back with this white flamingo box of organic produce that he had bought on a that he regularly went to buy. Those kind of things, that just kind of this holistic awareness that the food we eat and the clothes we wear and all those kind of things are big part of a bigger system, and that we are custodians of the planet and we need to take care of that, and we have a responsibility, was just kind of ingrained in me as a kid. So I think that's partly why.
But I mean, there's something more there that you know, they weren't just talking about it, they were living it.
Yes.
So their behaviours were totally congruent with their beliefs, what they were saying, which is a powerful thing as a child.
Yeah, exactly. And also kind of that they were very anti-elitist. and slightly angry at times, I would say, especially my dad, angry with the elite. And I think that kind of was in a way passed on to me, but just very different. I think it's incredibly important that we actually work actively with the established elite, if we can call it that. If we want to change things, it doesn't really help. Since I was a kid, I always had this kind of intuitive feeling that it doesn't help that we just fight each other. We need to collaborate and we need to find ways to understand each other and meet each other instead of just being angry at them.
Was that a lesson learned when you were doing your rainforest campaign, or did that come later?
As I said, I think it's always just kind of been part of who I am, that for me, it doesn't make sense to be angry at other people. It makes sense for me to understand where they're coming from. And in a way, that was shown in how my kind of career turned out, in the sense that as soon as high school was finished, I went to work for the volunteers through which I had bought the pieces of the rainforest as an 8-9-year-old. So I was around 19 when I went to the Ecuadorian part of the Amazon and worked for that NGO, because I thought that my life would be within environmental NGOs. So I wanted to kind of get an early start there. And when I was there, it dawned on me that if I really want to change things, I need to work actively with those that are doing the damage, and I need to be able to understand where they're coming from. I need to understand how they view the world, instead of just doing environmental work kind of disassociated from them. So I went back and took a business degree to understand the tools and mindset, et cetera, in the business community, because I wanted to work actively with them. I didn't believe that they were just like, that the corporates were representing the force of the evil, because behind every corporation is a human being as well. But you need to be able to understand each other and collaborate if we are to change things. So I think that's kind of been ingrained in me all the time. I don't know where that come from. It was just kind of an intuitive desire.
Did you ever struggle for focus at all, you know, as you left school and sort of embarked out on your working life?
No. I think my challenge has probably been the opposite, that I've sometimes been too focused and too determined and ambitious and very focused on what I wanted. So as soon as I finished business school, I became part of and ended up being the director of something called the Copenhagen Climate Council, which was an alliance of high-level business leaders like Richard Branson and Jim Rogers from Duke Energy in the U.S., Li Xiaoling from China Powers, but also scientists, climate scientists that were actively working to build kind of excitement around a new political deal that were to be negotiated in December 2009. So I headed that group for 2 or 3 years. And so my problem has more been like being too focused, too kind of caught up in work, that I kind of forgot other important parts of living a thriving life.
Coming into the workplace from out of education, what sort of challenges did you encounter taking on? I mean, that's a big in at the deep end kind of role, working with characters like that at such a young age. You know, were there doubts? Were there, you know, how on earth do I do this kind of questions buzzing around in your mind? Or
yeah, of course there were. I think on one hand, I am blessed to not be kind of wowed by people in the sense that I see us all as equal. I'm not really impressed by people of certain status. So that came in handy.
You don't get starstruck.
No, exactly. I don't know why, but I don't. But that definitely came in handy carrying out this work. But of course there were. I mean, I was a woman in a space that were massively dominated by men in suits. And here I was, the director of the Copenhagen Climate Council. And of course, I had others. There was the chairman, Tim Flannery. We had a strategic advisor who had been the former climate advisor for Tony Blair, Nick Rowley. And I was also heading or collaborating closely with another guy called Pierre Meidelstrup, who was there as well. But I was like the director of the Copenhagen Climate Council and had to kind of lead that group for 2.5 years. And of course,
but you were there I presume, because someone believed in you, right, in the first place. You don't just land into a position like that. You find your way into it.
It was a bit of a coincidence, actually. It would be because I was in a meeting with Tim Flannery and Connie Hedegaard, who was former Minister of Environment for Denmark, and she ended up becoming like the lead figure in the negotiation process for Denmark. And we were at a meeting together on the day that Denmark were announced as the country that will, or the city that would host the important COP15. And that was just a coincidence that there was a conference that I was involved in at the time. Because as soon as I finished school, I wanted to work within the field of environment. And I did that through a Scandinavian think tank called Monday Morning. And we were in a meeting together. The announcement was just made. And we just developed this idea during the meeting that, okay, we asked Connie, what is the most important thing we could do to help you in this process? And she said, an alliance of business leaders and scientists that could help us bring the business case argument when we are meeting with Chinese business leaders and negotiators, US business leaders and negotiators. And I just happened to be there. And I think I have that kind of drive and can make things happen quickly and turn an idea into something concrete. So I just kind of went with it. And then it was just natural that I was heading the project. In a way, I hired myself.
So a bit of serendipity, but you kind of make your own luck.
Yeah, I guess it's a combination.
Back to the kind of self-doubt and the how do I do this? What were the things that you were conscious that you were weakest at, that you've really had to work hard at?
I think both in terms of all the organizations that I had, that I have started, also, Sustainia that I started in 2012, that quickly became very, very big and then had Arnold Schwarzenegger and Pharrell Williams and a lot of people of that character involved. And we quickly grew a big audience and with Copenhagen Climate Council as well. I think my biggest challenge is that I'm very driven and dedicated and ambitious and visionary, but I'm also extremely introverted. And heading organizations and managing a team, creating excitement and having that sensitive abilities that I like in leaders, I would say that I possess. But being in receptions and doing hardcore networking, I hate. And you can call it a weakness. There's also strengths associated with being a more sensitive introvert, but it's definitely something that I have found as a challenge from time to time that I really, really, I love being on a stage giving an inspiring keynote and I'm good at it, but I hate everything around conferences. I hate the chit chat and the small talk. I would rather sit in a circle with people and have true deep conversations about things. Mm-hmm. And that's just not always possible in the world that we live in today.
But you've gradually found your tribe.
Oh, yes, definitely. And you find those along the way. But the reason I mentioned the part about being an introvert is that I think many, many people out there are introverts that really want, that are dedicated about having an impact and making change and creating things. So I think my message is just that you can do that and that you can slowly find your way in doing this. And when people get to know you, they see that that you have other things to offer, even though, I mean, most people wouldn't kind of maybe judge me or see me as an introvert because I've learned to kind of put on a happy face and just be at the reception for a very short time. But when I'm there, I do my best to enjoy myself and do it in a way that I'm comfortable with and is aligned with who I am. But that has not always been the case. I've always felt kind of very, especially in my 20s, just incredibly uncomfortable in those situations where that is more fitting for social extroverts.
But I think a lot of people would recognize that. You know, you're far from alone. I heard once that there was, you know, thinking about leadership teams and the dominance of extroverts within them, you know, the lack of diversity. And we think about the obvious things like gender or race or what have you. But, you know, the introvert-extrovert thing is definitely an area where there's a lack of diversity. You know, and it's it seems to me that part of the problem is that introverts often struggle to find their voice and make contributions. But as much of that is about the, you know, the dynamic between them and extroverts. You know, an expectation from extroverts that, well, you know, if it is all said and done on that conversation, you know, and you know, let's make a decision on it. And, you know, often people need time to reflect and throw a grenade in later on, which can well often completely deflect the flow of the conversation and the decision that's made. But this sort of tendency towards kind of quick decision making, quick cycles on things, and lack of understanding and empathy for the contribution that introverts make is as much the part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I have never had a problem making quick decisions. For me, it's not been kind of in that area. I mean, I like to reflect around things, but I love to be dynamic and making quick decisions as long as they feel intuitively right. Mm-hmm. It's more the kind of being all over the place and like, and I need to talk with that person, and that can all often be very cherished, that kind of culture, which I'm not going to do it. I have no interest in being a leader in that way. And I would like to kind of make a stand for another approach to leadership, and also the way that you actually cherish and value your employees or your team, that it's not often the ones that are the most talkative that are right. So how can we create an environment where everyone gets to talk, not just the ones that are very out there?
So looking back at your career so far, I mean, there's been episodes in it, and you've leapt from one thing to another, you know, been a serial founder of various different organizations and initiatives, campaigns, and so on. You know, what drives that? I mean, do you have a low boredom threshold? Are you an opportunity seeker and recognizer, and you get attracted towards a new opportunity space where you see something needs doing?
I think it's a seeing something that needs doing. So the Copenhagen Climate Council, we always knew that was just running up until the big climate summit in Copenhagen in December 2009. And that political summit was actually a complete failure. That was not our fault, but it was just the political negotiations part of it that was just kind of, everything was breaking down. And heads of state were fleeing the scene because they could not agree on a successor to the Kyoto Protocol back then. We now have a treaty in place that was negotiated in December 2015 in Paris. Anyways, everyone who had been involved in the COP15 process, which was many, also big corporates, everyone was suddenly having a climate strategy, which was amazing. There had been amazing kind of movement and mobilization and excitement being built around the business potential of a strong global deal. And when negotiators and politicians were not able to come up with an agreement, everything was just kind of, that exciting momentum was just completely lost on the ground. And everyone who had spent their lives traveling the world to make people aware of this were incredibly depressed. So NGOs and negotiators, etc., we were many who were incredibly depressed in the months after Copenhagen, and I was one of them. And I actually fled to San Francisco, just wanted to get out of it, and thought, how can the agenda that I'm so passionate about and have been so my entire life, how can I make this interesting, fascinating, desirable, even sexy? So what had happened in the lead up to Copenhagen was that many communicated this issue in boring technical abbreviations, mm-hmm. Doom and gloom stay scenarios. The whole agenda was just very, very fear-based. I wanted to change that. I wanted to make sustainability exciting. I wanted to make the destination of a sustainable, thriving future something that people understood. So what do we mean when we talk about a sustainable future? For many, it was like, we don't really mean what we talk about. Is this about giving up a lot of things and moving into small huts, or what is this? So I created a little alliance with corporations like Cisco, Microsoft, IKEA, etc., and communications experts that dedicated a year of their time to work on how can we create a new exciting narrative. We worked with Pixar making an animation movie for kids and teenagers that made sustainability exciting. And I wrote the guide to Sustainia, which was like, what is the vision of a sustainable future? And what does this mean in terms of the food that we eat, the buildings we live in, the clothes we wear, etc.? And while writing that book, I saw something bigger grew in my mind. I wanted to create an organization around Sustainia. So when that one-year project finished, it was more like a launch of an actual organization. So, and that quickly grew then to be to reaching hundreds and millions of people and issuing Sustainia 100 solutions portfolio each year, working with companies on writing scenario reports for their industry and mobilizing the bottom up, etc. So everything was kind of like it led into the next. It wasn't because I got bored with things. It was just kind of how things developed and changed during the process.
So there will be people listening who have a mix of admiration for what you've done. I mean, there are many, many people who try and get campaigns off the ground to try and develop movements around issues. You've successfully done it and at a pretty epic scale. What lessons have you learned from that? What were the things that mattered most in the very, very early days in terms of getting the right partners on board, getting the right kind of traction and momentum going that you can share with people? So, these are the sort of magic ingredients, if there are any.
Trusting your guts, dare to be different, being courageous. I mean, in 2012, when we launched Sustainia, we launched it with Arnold Schwarzenegger as our chair. It was a brand that had many colors, like pink and turquoise and purple. It was very colorful, very, very different. And one of our first events were when we launched the first Sustainia 100 at the Rio Plus 20 Summit, which was a big sustainability summit, which had both corporates and people movements, NGOs, etc. Present. And many was like, isn't that a bit too colorful, too festive? And it's headed by a young, I think I was 31 at the time. I could have gone down the path where I would be like, I need to play it safe because I'm a young woman, because I want to do something different. I need to tone things down a bit. But I think, yes, it did probably provoke some of the people that was there. And I knew that for a fact, that some of the kind of very old angry environmentalists thought it was a bit kind of too festive, the kind of event that we did. But it was providing a new energy and atmosphere into the sustainability movement. And it did, I think, open people's eyes towards, hey, how about we actually make this fun? How about we make this journey playful? That I know other people have been inspired about. So the lessons learned is like, if you have an idea and if you have a vision of something, and what I'm trying to say now is not don't listen to advice, but just if there's something in you that feels so strong and you just know you have to do that, even though it may seem counterintuitive, or when your mind gets in the way, rationalizing things, you get scared, is just do it, would be my key advice.
How critical to that launch was having someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Again, it was one of those things that kind of divided the waters. Some thought it was amazing and exciting. He can reach an audience that environmental NGOs cannot. But some were also like, that's not serious, and he drives a big Hummer, and he's like, da, da, da. There will always be criticism. And of course, I am as sensitive of criticism as we all are. We all want to be loved and appreciated and admired in a way. So of course, that also got to me. But again, what dominated me most was a core inner voice that told me, well, this is what is needed right now. That we kind of do something different, and that we allow different kind of voices to speak up for sustainability and reach new audiences. We can't continue communicating to the already converted people. We need to engage a new target group in a way.
And it would have come at a time when, around about the same time, if memory serves me right, was Inconvenient Truth, perpetuating that kind of doom and gloom scenario rather than an optimistic narrative.
Yeah, and in many ways we were kind of the opposite, but also the answer. And I really truly admire Gore's work, and his work has been so incredibly important in terms of letting people become aware of the seriousness of the issue. And to me, it's devastating as well. But for me personally, I need to be more focused on the solutions and the opportunities and the alternative model, because otherwise I get too depressed. I am way too sensitive to be too focused on the seriousness of the problem. I'm aware because I've been in this field my entire career, so I'm perfectly aware about loss of biodiversity. We lose minimum 200 species a day. Our soils and rivers are depleted of important nutrients, and our air is polluted, and soon we have more plastic in our oceans than marine life. All of those things I'm completely aware of, but I get too depressed and my energy is just so low if that's the area that I'm in. I want to be in the solution space and provide people an exciting alternative.
There'll be people listening thinking, how on earth do you go about persuading, you know, as a 31-year-old, how do you go about persuading an A-lister like that to come on board?
Oh, what a... trying to think back how that actually happened. Well, we had a close... He had just launched Regions 20, which is a very action-oriented NGO that he created as an alternative of... He was very tired of the endless discussions that he felt didn't lead anywhere in the G20. So he wanted to focus on building an NGO called Regions 20. And the director of Regions 20, we had a close relationship with, and we were kind of partners, two sides of the coin in a way, and we wanted to work together. So it was a way of establishing our relationship that kind of the founder of Regions 20, Arnold Schwarzenegger, became the chair of Sustainia. And he just loved Sustainia. He loved the fact that it was vibrant and exciting and solution-focused. That's very much his brand as well, that he wants to focus on action. He's an action hero, and Sustainia was focused on action. So he wanted to support that.
In my experience, people say yes far more than they say no. You know, as long as you keep in mind, the worst they can say is no. What's the harm in trying?
Yes, exactly.
So coming back to this really important point you were making around narrative, and this has been a real thread through your work. You know, you've commented to me about the dominance of the technocratic kind of argument. You know, it doesn't motivate people to act, but you're much more about running towards pleasure and, you know, more optimistic, desirable, compelling futures. How is that expressing itself in the work you're doing now?
So, as I was heading Sustainia, I had a serious injury, a minor traumatic brain injury, which led me to kind of more or less be in a dark room for a year and a half. And it was a slow recovery process. And I could talk about that for a very long time, but I would cut it short and just be like, if when you lose all your abilities, when you lose everything and you're not able to cope with light or moving objects, or you're not able to read or write or even think and create ideas, is incredibly scary, especially when you have been a person that has always been very driven and action-oriented and hundreds of ideas all the time kind of cooking in your head. And all of a sudden, everything was just blank and I couldn't do anything. In many ways, that was a nightmare, but it was also a reconnection with something very profound. One was nature, because I discovered that the only place where I felt comfortable and where I felt that I was putting myself into a recharger was when I relaxed in nature. The other thing was a reconnection with myself and my inner core and who I really am. And those two things goes together. But it was, I mean, reconnection to nature and reconnection to myself. And And in that kind of profound experience of, okay, there you are, because having been so incredibly busy for over a decade, starting things, heading things, managing teams and people, becoming a mother to my beautiful daughter, was in a way, I had forgotten myself. I had been too focused on my mission. I had been too focused on executing, acting, and just being out there, performing on all platforms of my life, that I didn't have time for myself at all. So that was just kind of gradual disconnection from myself. And me realizing and experiencing the reconnection made me go down a path of exploring biophilia and the importance of nature to your health and well-being, neuroscience, shamanistic cultures, the whole range. I mean, in a way, slightly spiritual adventure, just exploring a new side to life that I had not been exposed to at all throughout my life. And I just realized that in order to really transform our societies in the way that I've desired my entire life, we cannot allow a discussion that only focuses on political negotiations and agreements, technology or financial mechanisms, which I had slightly done, focused on solutions, etc. We need to be aware that how we show up in this life towards the people that are close to us, our employees, our co-workers, our team, everything is reconnected and interconnected. And I launched Regenerators with Giles, who has been on sort of a similar journey. He has written The Nature of Business and The Illusion of Separation and Future Fit, and has very much been in that space of leadership, business, nature for a long time. And
so for listeners, this is Giles Hutchins, who's was interviewed in another episode.
Yeah, he and I launched Regenerators 2-3 months ago. And with Regenerators, I had the idea of creating something that was holistically focused. So we focus in Regenerators on regenerative living, regenerative leadership, regenerative systems and organizations, and regenerative solutions. So that is everything from how we take care of ourselves, how we regenerate ourselves, so we show up in the world tapped into the life force that we all have inside of us if we actually nurture and take care of that. It's also how we design our organizations. How can we move away from these very rigid, old school, mechanistic structures that is actually depriving our souls and hurting our health and well-being? And it's also limiting our creative abilities. And what we need now more than ever is creativity and innovation. It's also about how we actually create products and services that we need to fully transform to a regenerative circular economy. We need our products to be based on the intelligence of nature instead of being destructive. And it's what I have lacked without knowing in my other initiatives, mm-hmm. to kind of combine both the inner and the outer. Because if we only focus on the outer, we will burn out. And it's solutions and technologies and political agreements can all be pieces of the puzzle. But if we don't have the glue and the soul and the energy needed to put these things together, they will continue being locked down in silos, fighting each other and not making the change at the speed that is required. So the task that we as mankind is being called to focus on is both the inner and the outer, to reflect on how am I showing up in my daily work? Am I being too locked down in an old school way of viewing productivity and hard work and being an entrepreneur or a leader that is very much focused on or grounded in fear of coming behind, fear of losing your title, fear of not being what you hope to be, and instead, can we create a transformation process that is more playful, that is more fun, that is more focused on us being nourished. Because when we are nourished and when we show up as full people, the change and the collaborations and the alliances that we are able to make is so much more fruitful. When we work in the flow and when we feel that we can be truly ourselves and not changing ourselves. As when I reflect back on where I were 10 years ago when I started out Copenhagen Climate Council, I to a large extent, I felt I had to be someone I was not in order to be successful. And that has been a major learning and something that I'm very passionate about passing on to millennials, that the best you can do is to be yourself. And first of all, you have to figure out who you are and have that constant reconnection with yourself, which can be through nature, it can be mindfulness or wherever, but just checking in with who you really are. Because I promise you, when you do that, the foundation, the strength, the ideas, the power of the and impact you're able to make is so much more forceful if you have that kind of fear-based, fragile foundation.
So, and what strikes me about this is this has all come about largely as a result of misfortune, an accident that has given you pause, given you time to think and discover and develop these kind of insight, not just worldview, but also inner view. How do you support people through that kind of personal transition in an intentional way?
That or how in general you can do that?
Well, maybe how you intend to do it. You know, what's your ambition for impact with regenerators?
So what we hope to do is to make leaders, and when I say leaders, I don't mean just executives. In a way, we are all leaders, all who want to lead the change towards a new thriving paradigm and want to help make the current model obsolete by developing a new exciting model. What we hope, the message that we hope to put across and help leaders with is how they can redesign their life to have those nourishing oases throughout their day and to establish a stronger inner connection that they can tap into anytime, everywhere, in meetings, when they are on a stage, when they're doing a meeting, facilitating a change process, while inspiring them with seeing the benefits of reorganizing their organization, both in terms of how they produce, how they collaborate, how they tap into the life force of their employees. So instead of all the costs associated with internal friction, stress, hyper competition, how can they actually tap into a thriving life force that improves their creativity, innovation, lowers sick days, but also equips them with the power needed to transform to a 21st century business model? So for us, it's about connecting the dots between the inner and outer and making leaders realize that everything is interconnected. And that they need to find the inner courage to break away and break free from the old destructive models. And as I said before, we are all human beings. We are animals living on this planet. And when you, for example, as we do, take leaders out in nature and provide that space for them where they can sit under a tree and reconnect with the planet they live on and themselves, something magic happens. Something magic happens in everyone, because we are all animals living on a planet, but we have become too disconnected with that. And we have shut ourselves off in concrete buildings, and we have been taught and schooled and geared towards a mindset that is extremely, in a way, hyper masculine, hyper competitive, hyper disconnected from being a thriving human being. And what I desire with the regenerators is to make the case that let's use our intelligence as human beings to co-create a new thriving model that is regenerative and not degenerative, not destructive towards ourselves as human beings, but also the planet that we live on. Especially, I mean, the most stressed generation is the millennials, which really concerns me. And that in combination with, I mean, when people are stressed, it's really hard for them to have this holistic approach to ecosystems and to being good planetary custodians, because you have tunnel vision and you become very focused on getting what you want and the next steps, and everyone else is seen as a distraction. So for me, I've never really been that concerned about stress. I saw it early on as something that was not relevant for my field, but now I see that our health and well-being and how we feel as human beings are so essential for the change that we're able to make. So for me now, everything is tied together. So that's also what we try to do with Regenerators, to connect these dots for leaders to see that everything is interconnected. And it's not irrelevant how your employees are feeling in terms of how they're able to innovate. And it's not irrelevant how your business models are geared. Are they geared towards actually delivering more value, or are they just destructive and very, very short-term focused?
This sounds to me like another social movement coming on.
I hope so. I think I want to say that for me, it's incredibly important that there's no one person leading the way. For me, my partnership with Giles Hutchins is, for example, incredibly important. But what we're trying to do with Regenerators is also to see this as a collective. We are a collective of energies collaborating under the same umbrella of wanting the same. So Change Hackers could be a collaborator with Regenerators. I think our time calls for collaborations in completely new ways. And we need to let go of that mindset of building a new dynasty or a new castle. We need to move away from that and have us more see everything as important bricks in the bigger puzzle, and that we're all part of the same thriving ecosystem, joining forces in new, exciting ways.
100% agree. I think, Laura, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Change Hackers. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, Change Hackers.